we go. Here it is. I hope it picks up. Well, let's not spray the screen here. Did you hear that?
No.
Oh, God. Hold on. It's overflowing.
All right. That's a perfect place to start. Welcome back, everyone.
Drinking our sponsor here.
Yeah, drinking a beer from our sponsor, who every time we say the name, we get at least, you know, a tenth of a penny for sure. So enjoy that Hopewell. What is it? It's a lager.
We're sucking on the motherfucking Hopewell First Pills.
First Pills. Wow, that's bold. That's bold for a name.
Let's read the back. First Pills is the first beer ever brewed by Hopewell, and fittingly, the one we reach for most often. A Pilsner style lager with a bready malt profile and a snappy, noble hop finish. Tastes great anytime, but best with friends. And that's right. I'm here with my good buddy today and our good buddies at Hopewell, because we're going to be talking about a Hopewell sponsored double feature.
That's right. Coming up this Monday, May 13th, at the Music Box Theater in Chicago, Illinois, we will be screening two movies to celebrate moms. First up will be Clint Eastwood's The Bridges of Madison County on gorgeous 35mm.
Yeah.
And then we're going to follow that.
There's some cells of it. It's looking pretty.
It's beautiful. Thankfully, Warner Brothers takes care of their Mal Paso films. Yeah. Keep them stored proper.
That's right. He's their legacy.
Yes. And following that, we will be doing John Cassavetes' Gloria.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be sick. So, yeah, come the day after Mother's Day. People who celebrate Mother's Day on Sundays are lame. John's got a little cum on his upper lip. Let's start this episode.
Yeah, I got beer cum on my upper lip.
Yep. But yeah, it's gonna be sick. It'll be truly one of the things I feel like you would agree with this. Correct me if I'm wrong, but we love doing all sorts of different movies as much as we can. Rarely do we get to do one of the things we love, which is really pretty tender and touching double features for highs and lows. The most well-known one being Peggy Sue Got Married, Last Temptation of Christ, but we haven't done one like that in a long, long time.
Until
so we're really excited to be back for a beautiful day at the movies, celebrating moms, getting the feels together. I will be weeping, especially during the first movie, but then also in the second. So it's going to be great. So first, we're gonna talk about them in reverse order today. So we're going to talk about the second feature first. That is from 1980, Gloria, starring the inimitable Gina Rowlands.
We love her.
This is a movie that still, I think, when you bring up Cassavetes, it's one of the few left that people say, well, you know, can't win them all kind of thing. This still goes in that category, which I don't think is fair at all. I think this is a far more interesting movie than that suggests, and much more of a Cassavetes movie than nerds want to say it is, because it's still very much in his realm, I think. But this movie it's came to him.
Trouble. Yeah, this is not Big Trouble. I just want to say that. This is been to why people criticize it, but briefly, but it's like it is astounding that it's because this movie has probably had a weird home video life, you know, it kind of shuffled around. It didn't get the Criterion stamp right out the gate with Cassavetes, so it wasn't with that level of importance. But no, this is top tier Cassavetes. My opinion.
Oh, it's great. And this came to him. The plan was he wrote the screenplay and was just going to sell it to the studio. That was the plan. And then while they were talking about that, the studio said, well, Gina Rowlands is going to be in this. And he said, well, in that case, then it's mine. So
yeah, he liked money.
That's how we yes. They needed money for their passion project. the true last movie they gave us for Love Streams. So this movie paid for that.
Again, not big
not trouble. Alone.
Like, not big trouble. Although maybe he made some money back from what he lost on Love Streams with, although I don't think Big Trouble made any money. That's a
No.
Anyway, yeah, but we love
By the time Big Trouble comes around, our buddy, if you don't, I'm sure you all do, but Cassavetes was a brutal alcoholic and his liver was full of cirrhosis and really giving out while Big Trouble was happening. Absolutely. Well, also Love Dreams and also Glory. But it was really
Honestly, when we were pairing this, the original thing I wanted to do was Bridges of Madison County and Love Streams. But Love Streams recently played at the Music Box, so that was the... That was the reason we pushed away from that. But ideally, I saw this as like bridges and Love Streams. But
that's okay.
This works too.
This will be great too. And yeah, just along with what you're saying about Big Trouble, I also get annoyed when people say, oh, this is like Too Late Blues and A Child Is Waiting from his early career, where they're like, nah, he was just trying to make some money. They're not that good. I disagree. I think those movies are pretty worthwhile as well. But this one, I think, truly belongs with the rest as an excellent Cassavetes movie.
Yeah, I think Too Late Blues does too. I mean, it's like...
Child Is Waiting has enough to almost get it there, but yeah.
It's a weird one. I mean, the Child Is Waiting.
It's a
strange time at the movies, but...
Yeah, but so yeah, I guess we'll just go pretty quick on this one. We don't need to talk too much on it, I don't think, but I guess really kind of what we're addressing is some of the criticisms hurled at it. And one of the first people who confronted that directly, bless him, when Ray Carney did his Cassavetes on Cassavetes book, which is just, you know, it should be a buy in the house of movie lovers.
You need that. If you don't have it, if you're a film student out there and you want guidance or just something to make you feel good about the laborious, torturous process of birthing a movie, but read Cassavetes.
Truly, like whatever money you got from your Pell Grant instead of buying your textbook from your professor that semester, buy this instead.
Yep.
You will be happy. Truly. But so in that, basically when this movie comes out, a lot of people, you know, the positives, people are like, Gene is great, of course. That's it, you know. Kind of thing. I think that undersells Gina and the whole crew. As everyone knows, Cassavetes was very collaborative. He did not follow the idea that the director is the only creative force on a film set. Though he didn't allow like actual improv in the rehearsal process, like kind of like Mike Lee, he did, where they would kind of run through things and people could improv and he'd rewrite the script.
Yeah.
That happened here as well. Even though Cassavetes himself says, you know, it's a pretty straightforward movie. More than I make, but you know, we wanted to pull the magic out of it. And when he's talking about Gina, because she is obviously she's the core of this, you know, and he says, oh, it's just so good, this quote. Gina is subtle, delicate. She's a miracle. She's straight. She believes in what she believes in. She's capable of anything. It's only because of Gina's enormous capacity to perform that we have a movie, because a lot of people would be a little too thin to work on it. And I think that's pretty stellar. And then the biggest thing people foolishly say about this movie, I think, is they criticize the child performance. This kid named Juan Adames in the movie. I think it's, in my opinion, it's people just being trained to want what they think is a good quote unquote child performance from shitty movies that force kids to act like adults. That's why I love this performance so much, is because it's truly a child's performance.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And that's what, and Cassavetes quote about it, it's so perfect. He says, the kid is neither sympathetic nor non-sympathetic. He's just a kid. He reminds me of me, constantly in shock, reacting to this unfathomable environment. He was always full of excitement and wonderment as to what he was doing, trying to comprehend this fathomless story of a family being wiped out. I think that's perfect, and it's also important to note that Gina, especially, she refused to break character between shooting when she was with Juan, because she said the only way we're going to get anything out of him is if that we're just living in it at all times, and he's never thinking about it being a movie and not thinking about action. He's just being a kid. And I don't know, my rewatch of this one, I don't know about you, but yeah, I rewatched it the other morning, and I was pretty floored. It's performance is stellar, I think. Yeah, it's really
his performance is no different than many other child performers who end up in movies of this time. It's like, sure, there's an awkwardness. Maybe that's just due to there's an awkwardness to being a child, especially in a situation that's entirely run and governed by adults. So I've never seen that. I mean, sure, like you could point to things and being like, yeah, awkward, but it's like, it's never been enough that it's like shadowed the experience, overshadowed the experience of this movie. And the movie, you know, like to say anything for like how a child perceives things, like there's a intense amount of nervous, thrilling energy in this movie as they are trying to duck around. She's trying to hide him from these mobsters that are trying to kill him because this kid witnessed a murder. So she is kind of this like, I don't really give a fuck about kids person who has to reluctantly step into the role of a mother to make sure that this kid who witnessed the murder is not also murdered by the mob. And her ex is the mob chief. So awkward indeed.
And it's
just cool to see Cassavetes do something in this kind of like thriller mode, because like I don't think you could really call The Killing of a Chinese Bookie like a thrilling movie. You know what I mean? It's one of his very top greatest, but all of the structures, well, maybe not the structure, but like the payoff and
the things you come to a thriller for are subverted at every turn.
It's the structure
and then subverted
for sure.
Again over and over.
Right. So this is cool. It's like you get to see him actually doing something like this. But there's still enough of that Cassavetes-ness. Like I said, it's not Big Trouble where it's like, okay, this is clearly made by a guy in a different area. Like this is 100% in there. And is it any more goofy than like Minnie and Moskowitz? Which
I don't think so. I really don't think so.
Or even Opening Night. I mean, Opening Night goes to some pretty outlandish places. And
that's what they made right before this as well. So right. It's Opening Night into this. But I love to like, and one of the things I argued with someone about the kid and everything, I was like, but everyone's performance matches, in my opinion, because it's Cassavetes and Rowlands. They're smart, one, and two, they're not rich people, so they hang out with all sorts of types. So I love that for this movie, they cast real current gangsters that they did know in New York still. And they, in my opinion, it's the same style of acting as the kid, because these are not actors. These are people. They're just like, hey, we're shooting a scene in your world. Do what you would do in your world.
Yeah.
Cassavetes, of course, also famously refused to give motivation to his actors. You know, he would not give them that. He would give them the script and then tell them to find the character. And so here he's like, you guys are actual... these low-level like New York hoods, like all the guys in the final scene that we won't spoil, but it's just real dudes still working it.
Well, and that's you know, it's probably closest to something like Mikey and Nikki, which he starred in, and people like to say is like a Cassavetes-esque movie. And I mean, I guess if you're just talking about a shaky camera.
Yeah, if you just mean a shaky camera and some like longer takes and amazing performances, then sure, that means it's a Cassavetes.
Yeah, but it's it's closer in style to that. But you know, I don't think we need to convince too many people to come check out a John Cassavetes movie. So
Just if you haven't and you look at Letterboxd or talk to your nerd friends and they tell you it's a weak one, don't listen to them. Come give it a shot.
Absolutely. Don't fall into that. In fact, we have I'll say it right now, because now this is the halfway point. We have a second double feature series that is about to start in the city of Chicago. And we're trying to combat this very thing against people, you know, kind of like a reaction, like a gut reaction, needing to check Letterboxd to see what their friends or a bunch of random people have to say. So we're going to be doing a double feature series where there'll be one film that we tell you, and the second film it'll be a complete secret blind screening. You won't know till we hit play. So
we're not even gonna, well, we did, I guess we didn't talk about it, but we probably aren't even going to say it in the intro of the second movie. Like, we'll tell you about it, but we're not even going to tell you what the movie is. So truly, lights go down, then you find out.
Yeah, it'll be really fun because we're going to be able to unload some stuff that we would love to unload at the Music Box, but Music Box is a big institution. They have a lot of hands in different places, and a lot of hands are in their places. So it's like, you know, we wish we had more time to do everything that we dreamt up. So this is at the Davis in Lincoln Square in Chicago. This is going to be our attempt to do more there and maybe take some wilder chances. So what's the date on this one?
That one is May 23rd, Thursday, May 23, 7 p.m. Michael Mann's Collateral, which you know and love. And you're going to know and love it even more because if you haven't watched it in a theater since it came out, shit just goes off even harder.
Yeah. And then what we have, let's just say it will be very similar to the, if you had a beautiful movie and experience at Miami Vice and Organized Crime and Triad Bureau, Data State Lightning doesn't strike twice, but it does.
We're trying to force it to strike twice.
Yeah. Well, I guess lightning struck multiple times, but in the same place is what I mean.
Yeah, that's right. We didn't finish the fucking...
Yeah. Anyway. May 23rd, Collateral and a secret movie at the Davis Theater. Get your tickets. We'll see you there.
We'll see you there. And lots more shit coming. Francomania is going to pop up again soon in a lot of different places.
A lot of different places. This is
great.
So highs and lows will continue. There's something very special coming in July we're going to do that we can't talk about just yet. But if you come to this show, maybe we'll talk about it on stage.
Yeah. And I guess since the tickets are on sale, we talked about it last time, but the July show for Highs and Lows, tickets are also on sale.
Is it on the website?
I think so. Is it not?
I don't know. It doesn't matter. It's all good.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. Yeah. We're doing Tamara Davis's Crossroads alongside Morgan Caller by one Lynn Ramsey.
Well, that's our June show.
That's what I meant by July. Losing my mind. So, because it's May right now. It's not June yet. May right now. So, June, we will be doing what I just said. And it's going to be incredible.
There's no way that July is up yet because we're working on not only a special coming in July separate from this, but we have.
We're trying to make it real special.
We're trying to make this second, this Highs and Lows show really special. So stay tuned on that. Okay. Let's talk. We were just talking about Gina Rowlands and John Cassavetes. Let's talk about another male, white, mayo ass filmmaker and his lover muse, but in a different way than because we're gonna talk about Bridges of Madison County. Meryl Streep, as far as I know, did not fuck Clint Eastwood, but I would not be shocked.
I will get into it more. I won't go too far here at the gate, but they either decided to edge forever together after they shot these scenes, or they had to fuck after they finished shooting, because this is one of the most sensual films that exists on earth for my money. Truly,
there's no way.
As far as seduction goes, it is absolutely unreal.
There's no possible way they could have fucked during, because there would not be this movie if they had.
They wouldn't. They wouldn't allow it, and because they also, Clint did one of my favorite things. And he's smart. Some filmmakers know that you have to be patient and make sure the shooting schedule can work to shoot it in order.
Yeah.
And this is one of those movies. They shot it exactly in order of how we see it, because Clint and Meryl needed to be getting to know each other for the performances the same way the characters are. And goddamn, does it show. But yeah, they definitely did not fuck while they were shooting because the tension's too good.
Yeah. So we're going to get into a couple of things here. We're going to get into real quick just how this came about. We're going to get into where in Clint's life brought him to make one of the most emotionally moving, transcendent films maybe ever made, and possibly one of the greatest films of the 1990s all over the world. We're gonna get into, yeah, kind of like where in his filmography we've seen this kind of romantic, because this is not a type of guy that you like, you just make this and then it's just like bam and you're gone. Like, this is clearly a part of a very complex filmmaker that gets kind of routed into one lane throughout his entire career. Whether good faith, bad faith, if you want to make claims about his political affiliations, if you want to judge him for his extramarital affairs, you know, he's a complex individual, but we're just talking about the artist today and what brought him.
We've also talked about all of those things ad nauseum already throughout the history of the show, so today we focus.
Yeah. we're not going to talk about his feelings, his political feelings, like we did with our sweet friend Molly Lambert about American Sniper. We're going into romantic Clint, not gay Clint either. Our theories of him having
this is not one in the entry of gay Clint today.
Yeah. And gay Clint, you know, there's a funny thing we say. I don't believe he was secretly gay. I just mean that, like,
he was just a dude who was down to clown.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes, yes, yes. So let's go into the movie real quick. So we have Bridges of Madison County, 1995. This movie is started because it's a script at Amblin, and that is Steven Spielberg's film company. So Steven Spielberg was going to make this movie. And
he got it before the book was even done.
Right. He had read a manuscript of the book.
Which is crazy because the book sucks. We'll talk about that, I'm sure.
Yeah, I have not actually spent time reading the book because
it's a terrible book. Like, at best, you could praise it for being sultry in the way that it meant to be. I'll give it that. But the actual writing is bad city.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a dime store romance novel for middle-aged housewives to read. And it's definitely, as someone we know, Clint, with, like, we talked about American Sniper and what he likes to do with books and his adaptations, he does things very differently. Now, what he does with it emotionally, and instead of it making of like this kind of like dissection of this character, he's more of an observance of her, and it's really beautiful. So he moves away from certain things, reframes them, but Spielberg is the one that came up with the framing device for the movie, where it's the children going to look back on their mom's things at the beginning of the movie, who say, oh, we've discovered these letters about our mom and her secret life, which makes sense because this is a, you know, that idea is very Spielbergian, you know.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It makes perfect sense that he developed that idea.
It makes sense that he first sought out fucking Sidney Pollack and goddamn Bruce Beresford of all people to do this. And honestly, thank God none of those three made it. Steven... Well, or Sydney or Bruce. I'm so glad they didn't make this movie.
Even Spielberg, with what we know now about his life and his mom, especially from the Fablemans, oh, I can see him nailing Bridges of Madison County. It would be a different movie, totally. But yeah, he would have nailed it, and we would be talking about it as a great movie. But this is a very different movie. Pollock, I don't know what he would have done. Bruce Beresford, oh my God, coming off of Driving Miss Daisy, and he's doing this shit? Oh, no. Please.
Yeah, dude, because I'm like, I don't know about you, but it's, unless it's like, I don't know, Money Movers or Double Jeopardy or something, I don't get all too excited about a Beresford movie. I mean, Tender Mercies is pretty cool, and I guess there's the big ones, but he, to me, is not a not someone I think of as an auteur in the least, so I'm glad.
Oh, he's got a rough filmography. I don't think there's any way of putting that. I mean, I Tender Mercy.
Awesome movies, but there are also more, way more not awesome.
Yeah, I wanna say, what's the one? The Puberty Blues. I like Puberty Blues a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And Breaker Morant's, you know, it's cool, whatever. Mr. Johnson, all that shit, but he fancies himself too political to make a movie like this without getting annoying.
Oh yeah, he'd be. Yeah, I don't want to see that version of the movie. So this is the early 90s. So Spielberg had just done Schindler's List, and so he decides, I don't think I can do this. So eventually Eastwood is tapped. I guess Beresford was going to do it, but dropped out because Eastwood preferred the original script. Beresford had them do a rewrite. Eastwood said, no, the original one's better, so dropped out. Eastwood is being, I think Spielberg had started speaking with Isabella Rossellini and Catherine Deneuve to act in the movie because Francesca is an Italian woman. So, of course, you ask one Italian woman and one French woman to pretend to be Italian. And you know, apparently, you know, Eastwood just from the get-go said, no, I know it's going to be Meryl Streep. And and so it was. Weirdly enough, though, I don't, very ironically, 2 years before this, after his relationship with Sandra Locke fizzles out, which we're going to jump into very soon here, he starts dating Frances Fisher, the actress. She's, you probably know her from Unforgiven. She's like the head prostitute to want to get revenge on those motherfuckers in that movie. So he has an affair with her, and he has a daughter that he names Francesca. I'm sure he wasn't like, yeah, I'm going to make The Bridges of Madison County one day. The novel really technically hasn't, I can't read it, but I know I'm going to do this. So yeah, it's just a kind of a funny coincidence, but yeah, his daughter Francesca Eastwood, who is, I don't know if anyone knows this, in Twin Peaks The Return, she is the waitress at the very final episode when he's in that Texas roadhouse thing. Anyway, so Francesca is born, and so is the movie. And and you know, again, like, this is a movie of absolute tenderness. This is not a movie made in a vacuum. This is a movie made by someone who really connected with this material. So how did we get here? Where are we at? Let's talk about let's talk about Eastwood the lover, and let's talk about Eastwood the filmmaker. We'll try to do them both simultaneously. Now, we've discussed Eastwood is a pussy hound from early on, getting,
to say the least.
Yeah, having his first sexual experience at age 14 with one of his teachers in high school, who got so obsessed with him. I mean, who wouldn't? Even when he can't drive, you know? You know, it's like, God. So she reportedly, like, stalked him and was obsessed with him. And I guess if you're fucking your student, you might be a little, might be something missing there. But,
But I mean, I think that's the birth of how you get, he probably already had it just naturally, but how you get that million yard stare that Clint can do so well, that seduces all of us every time he's in a movie. I think it's probably born there when your hot teacher is like, you know, I know you're 14, but sorry.
You can get it, baby. Little boy, you can get it.
Little, poor little Clint.
I mean, I don't think it's something that you need to highlight, but it's like,
oh, no.
I mean, it's funny, but it's also like, you know, that's going to have some psychological,
yes, it is,
ramifications if you're a young boy. But alas, this is what he does. And, you know, he starts becoming a star, he starts starting movies, and he just starts just all over town, just clapping them constantly.
Just like true, also, I gotta say, because the term is overused a lot now, and it should be used and celebrated in its real form. Clint is a true slut. And I mean that truly, the highest praise, an actual slut. It's a problem for him. And he's awesome.
So, yeah,
he's a real deal slut, and we gotta give it up for our real deal sluts. Because just because you have a weird night one weekend doesn't mean you get to get the gold star to be a legendary slut.
Oh, no. This is a guy that slutted and ended up with some kids he didn't know about that just were kind of spread around the country.
I bet. Who knows? There's probably more.
Yeah, I'm sure there is.
We'll probably never know how many children Clint Eastwood has.
I'm sure there is. His first real relationship is with, in 1959, with a woman named Roxanne Tunis that he met on the set of Rawhide. She was a dancer and stunt woman. Apparently, they carried on what people considered to be an open marriage of people that never got married. Mm-hmm. And they spent a lot of time with each other. I mean, honestly, spoiler, kind of up through the 90s, they reportedly had maintained this, this relationship of the flesh, as one
might. Yeah, let's just say by the time Clint is ghost directing Tightrope, he's probably still hanging out with his queen, who was like, yeah, this is a sick movie, do it.
Yeah, she died last year.
And, oh, really?
Yeah.
Damn, I didn't know that.
And you know, Eastwood didn't comment on a lot of things. In fact, he didn't even comment on Sandra Locke's death, which.
Well, that's a, yeah.
We'll get to in a second. But yeah, she died at the age of 93. And Eastwood said he was devastated by the loss and described her posthumously as one of his true loves. And one of is key. But
yeah. Well, Clint, I don't think it was hard for Clint to fall in love. Let's say that.
Yes. And I think, like, maybe not in the way of a true slut. I think I'm sure he slutted up, but I think he was falling in love every time. And then quickly being like, what am I doing? Because, you know, this is a guy who, I mean, even Sandra Locke said, let me find this quote she said about him. Yeah, okay. So Sandra said in 2013, she said, I believe Clint knows who he is. He just doesn't like who he is. I do believe that Clint loved me as much as he is capable of love. And in the first 8 or so years together, he really wanted to be the man he knew I saw in him. I think he tried very hard, but eventually one's nature cannot change. Yeah,
that's so tragic and so relevant to Bridges.
It is. Yes, it is. And you know, that really says it all. So around 1972, this is when Eastwood meets Sandra Locke. He meets her on the lot at Universal. They start dating, and eventually she shows up in The Outlaw Josie Wales. She hadn't really been in a lot of stuff up until that point. I'm trying to think, what's that horror movie? Is it, it's the
Death
cinema,
Game?
A Reflection of Fear by,
I forgot she's in that.
Yeah. By William Fraker, who was the cinematographer of like Rosemary's Baby and, one of our favorites, Dusty and Sweets McGee.
Yes.
And Rancho Deluxe, Aloha Bobby and Rose. I mean, this cinematographer who did Reflection of Fear also did 1941.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. So he was kind of one of those filmmakers who didn't make, you know, he was like Freddie Francis or something that got a chance after doing all these movies to shoot his own. And Reflection of Fear is pretty good. Pretty good little movie. But Sandra Locke comes into the orbit of Eastwood. Now, at this time, Sandra is married to a gay man. Mm-hmm. She is married to a man by the name of... Fuck, where is it? Okay, she's married to a sculptor named Gordon Anderson, who was her lawful husband since 1967. Mm-hmm. Now, this was a marriage of convenience. He carried on. He had... His lover, and she had hers. So when Eastwood and her met, I think they saw in each other like, oh, we both like being... Oh, and I should say Eastwood is married also at this point.
Yes, they're both married.
Yeah, he's married to did a really good job of taking notes for this. Margaret Johnson. Yes. So he's married to Margaret Johnson. She's married to Gordon Anderson. They start dating and they see that they like, oh, you like being married and fucking around. Cool, me too. So, you know,
eye for like a nice wheel, as they say.
Yeah, they're like, I see what's up here. So he does the Outlaw Josie Wales and the Gauntlet with her and Bronco Billy, like right in a row. And, you know, that's kind of the start of that. And I will say, previously to this, 1973, he makes a film called Breezy, which is maybe his first attempt at, like, you know, like love being captured, even though the movie is not really about a love affair that's so consuming. Yeah. It's more about a guy who meets a 17-year-old girl who, uh-huh, it sounds more tawdry than it is. It's shockingly very tame and could probably pass the 2024 muster, but, you know, it's more about a guy kind of discovering himself.
Yeah, and I think I would say that's the step that has to happen between Play Misty For Me and then Breezy. Yeah. And then all this life happens, then we get here. Because Play Misty For Me, his first directed movie, I'm not going to get excited again because it's a million times on this show. But Play Misty For Me also has some romance stuff worked into it. Very different, of course, but...
Yeah, very different.
And to me, if he's starting to, you know, he's interested in those relationships. So,
yeah, I mean, like, I guess Sudden Impact kind of starts to show his, like, game recognized game literalization of Sandra Locke, and that he compares her character in that to his Dirty Harry character.
Well, and that, especially Sudden Impact, that's tawdry. Sure. The character Sandra's playing to you.
Tightrope, I guess, shows him kind of going into more hitting those melodramatic points that he kind of alludes to in other movies. Pale Rider kind of comments on the Breezy relationship, mm-hmm, a little bit. But Heartbreak Ridge is probably the first where you kind of see the framing being about how he fucked up as a husband along the way, even though that movie is a million things going on in it. And I don't think that's its focus, but...
It's a lot. And just a shout out before we keep going, the director of photography for that, Jack N. Green, is the guy who shoots Bridges, which we'll get into the cinematography, because that was when he finally got to step into the seat, because he was working on Gauntlet and shit and everything in between. But
yeah, and this is 1985-86. This is around the time where Clint and Sandra are having some issues. This is around the time where Eastwood divorces his wife, and according to his biographer Richard Schickel, I guess he expected Sandra Locke to divorce her husband at the time, but she didn't. There's a lot of speculation onto what went on. There's the affairs Eastwood was beginning to have at this point, but according to Sandra Locke, she didn't know about those until after the divorce. I'm sure she picked up that he was probably...
Oh, yeah. Things didn't feel good, even if she didn't know. Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of things, you know, happening around this time. And it's really by the time, we get to Bird that we really start seeing a man who's, like, showing the relationship between an artist and the person they love. And Bird is a torturously beautiful, moving, upsetting depiction of Charlie Parker and his wife Chan at kind of a turning point artistically in his life. Forest Whitaker plays Charlie Parker. Diane Venora does an unbelievable job as his wife Chan in that movie. And it really, I think on the world stage, that movie showed a kind of newfound maturity with Eastwood.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the kind of, you know, if you call it like an announcement when a filmmaker, you know, does something a little different. I'd agree. I think that's the time when people are like, oh shit, okay. This isn't we're not going to keep just saying the guy from the guy from the spaghetti westerns makes movies, you know.
Right, exactly. I mean, yeah. You know, it took the French, you know, ones to really kind of like say that. So, and it also, I think, brought within Eastwood a newfound confidence, because up until this point, I mean, he'd made a couple of movies which he, I mean, according to people on set, directed, but he didn't take credit for them. He let his stunt person take credit. Those would be Every Which Way But Loose, Any Which Way You Can, Pink Cadillac, and Tightrope. Pink Cadillac is the same year, I believe, as Bird. I think that's right. But, you know, it's like showing that, like, that was probably one of the lowest points of his career when he made Pink Cadillac. And I quite like Pink Cadillac, so I'm not.
It's right after. So it's in between. So between Bird and White Hunter is Pink Cadillac.
Yes. And that's like, you know, I guess many people consider that to be one of the worst things he's ever in, which, again, I do not agree with that. So when Bird, I think he sees this kind of newfound sort of like, yeah, all right, I'll give it my best. And it's between Bird and all these where he breaks up with Sandra Locke. You know, Sandra, I think, was very aware of what was going on. I mean, in 1980, in Any Which Way You Can, she sings a song called One Too Many Women in Your Life.
Mm-hmm. Well, that quote you read, I mean, you know, I don't think it was a lack of communication. I think from day one, she, you know, was like, I see who you are. I see who you can be. Let's fucking give it a shot together, you know?
So. Right. And Eastwood had said in the press, this is the woman that made him monogamous.
Yep.
So it was a big deal that he was dating her. So we got the song. We know Sandra knows what's up. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to probably figure out what's going on with your relationship at that point. So,
well, I think they were really like pretty insanely close, like, you know, like from what everything he said, she said, everyone said, they were a very, like, when it was working, they were, you know, a little bit inseparable kind of thing. So
I mean, they clearly
very well,
clearly they were inseparable. I mean, like, it's she starts showing up in everything he does, and he sees her as a muse, especially when, and we've talked about the Razzies before, I think on our last episode, but, you know, all they did was point out about how bad of an actress she was.
Which is insane. Wrong.
Yeah.
Dude, like, why something like Death Game is elevated so much is because of Sandra. In my opinion, she elevates everything she was in.
I mean, sure. I mean, No. She's great. I mean, and right now I think it's right at this point. It's like 86. So it's when things are starting to kind of change that there's a very important, but kind of often forgotten piece of the puzzle of Clint's filmography and his relationship and probably how he got to Bridges of Madison County. And we've talked about this show before. Spielberg's back, a show called Amazing Stories. And on Amazing Stories, Eastwood does an episode called Vanessa in the Garden. And in that, Harvey Keitel plays I'm assuming an impressionist painter from France is what they're trying to say, even though in shots, it's clearly shot like in the same like California residence that they shot White Hunter, Black Heart. Like
I guess it doesn't fucking matter where it is, but
it doesn't matter. There's a funeral scene and then there's palm trees in the back and it's like, yes, France. Little France. But you know, that doesn't matter. In fact, I think what's cool about this movie with all this background is you can look at this as kind of a weird daydream that Eastwood might have been having in his home at the time, because it's about Harvey Keitel paints. He's a renowned painter, i.e. filmmaker, who is early on finds success and is finally being recognized as an artistic person and not just someone who paints. So there's obviously some autobiographical thing going on in this one episode of TV, but Sandra Locke stars in it as his wife, his muse, who he paints. One day she is killed in a carriage accident. And she starts reappearing to Harvey Keitel but then vanishes whenever he gets close to her. So he realizes that he has to keep making paintings about her in the situations he wants to be with her in. And then he realizes he can be with her. It's a moving 30 minutes of television. There's
absolutely
no other way around it. And it's kind of doomsy in the way that it is portraying Sandra Locke and what she meant to Eastwood at that point and how she was inevitably going to haunt him, because I don't think you can be in this relationship for that long and not feel this person like a presence all the time.
No, and especially because what we said, like, this is clearly the first relationship that Clint has been in since that happened with teacher, I would say, that someone locked him down, you know, that he was like, yes, I will. This is just us, you know?
Right. Because Francis Fisher, I don't think it was ever like that. There's the Tunis character, who Roxanne Tunis, that could be the other part of this puzzle, maybe a little bit, considering how long they knew each other and stayed in touch. So yeah, if you haven't seen This Amazing Stories, I don't know where you can find it. If you're a Patreon member, you can hit us up. We'll hook you up.
If you want the physical version, and I would say it's worth it at large outside of Clint's pretty awesome show all the way through, you can buy the DVD box set from Umbrella Entertainment.
Oh, well, there you go. I love that.
That's what we did for our Zemecka show. So.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, because our boy Bobby Z does a stellar episode in there too.
Yeah, there's a lot of great episodes. If you want to listen to us talk about the cool episodes of that, you can go find that Robert Zemeckis episode. But yeah, so I guess we get to Unforgiven after Bird, which is probably the closest to romance we got at this point. And what's interesting is it's only the way it frames it at the beginning, at the end. It's the coda at the end. It's the opening of the movie. Is the whole movie is about how could this character who we don't meet be in love with this Clint Eastwood character, and how could she love this man after everything he's done? And that's how the movie is bookended. And it honestly, you don't have that in the movie. You still have a really, really good revisionist Western, but you don't have the power of that movie. And
you aren't gutted. Every time you want it.
Yeah. So, you know, he's clearly a guy who understands love and feels it, no matter how bad he is at enacting it and honoring it in his own life. And we're really not here. There's not a judge thing on this. I mean, I would hope to not do this to the person I love in my life, but I didn't have the life that Clint did. I don't have constant attention on me all the time. I didn't fuck my teacher when I was 14 years old. I don't look like Clint, you know? So, or have an iota of his talent. So, you know, it's...
Well, yeah, and it's just for, I guess, people listening, like, it truly, all of this will somehow make Bridges even more powerful. Because Clint's, like, whole story, like, the whole complete picture is very rarely talked about. You just get you get pull quotes, you get pull interviews, all that shit. So it's truly, it's worthwhile to position this.
Yeah, just as worthwhile it is to center your presumed politics of Eastwood with stuff like Sniper or Gertrude Jewell, you know, this is positioning what you might think of him as a ladies' man, as a an unloving pussy hound. You know, I think that this kind of shows that he is way... Eastwood is nothing but complicated. And that's just the only way you can look at him as a filmmaker. A lot like most filmmakers. So between Unforgiven and Bridges of Madison County is a perfect world. Very, 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 very good movie for Mr. Eastwood. And
I do think the tenderness of that also good to see, because that's a really soft movie. It's kind of, you know, and where Gloria can be harsh, actually, not that dissimilar storylines. That one is very, very tender. And I do think if Clint made it at a different point in his career, it would have been either more harsh, you know, or I don't think it get any softer, but you know what I mean. It's just he's clearly like really his heart is aching. The world is confusing again, you know, and so he wanted a nice story about someone who doesn't have someone to take care of them, finding someone who maybe will.
You know? Yeah. And another thing where a kid is just a kid in a movie and he does a pretty good job at it. Yeah. No, I mean, this is funny. This this double feature is really about the movies that we're not showing that are in close proximity to it.
It's true, yeah.
About the notes you don't play.
Well, and you know, it's easy to talk about a lot of jazz and jazz influences, both of these two. So,
absolutely. So, 1995, we get to Bridges of Madison County, and with everything we've kind of said about his romantic life at this time, you know, you do have to kind of take stock of where he was. So, we've mentioned this kind of torturous relationship with Sandra Locke, especially at the end. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of things about how he might have screwed up a deal for her at Warner Brothers. A lot of this is alleged. Nothing of this is actually backed up. He might have messed with a production of her movie Rat Boy, which no one was going to know because you couldn't take the quality of that movie enough to be like, was something happening behind the scenes? And, you know, and I love Sandra Locke. I'm not here to shit on Rat Boy. I do, in fact, quite like the film she did after Rat Boy. Impulse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Impulse with Teresa Russell is a pretty good movie. But I digress. She's moving on with her life. Eastwood's moving on with his. But around this time in Eastwood's life, he has met. So there's Frances Fisher, who he's had a daughter with. But it's right around this time, like 1993, where he first meets and starts dating the year Bridges of Madison County came out, the woman he was most previously married to. Dina Ruiz. Dina Ruiz was a TV anchor. I don't really know much about her other than she was part of Mrs. Eastwood and Company. Which didn't work out so well. In a horrible kind of sad prophetic kind of thing, she says, "Oh, I hope this doesn't ruin our marriage." And it did.
Yeah.
So Eastwood, you know, has moved on. I mean, he's never not going to be moved on. But at the time where this extremely romantic film in his filmography comes out, he is getting away from Sandra Locke. He's still seeing this person who he's had affairs with kind of his life, who he called one of his great loves, Roxanne Tunis. He's just had a kid with Frances Fisher. And he's just met the woman who he's going to marry and then divorce in like the late 2000s. It's a lot going on for a man's penis and heart at that time.
That's what's called just like a penis and heart, the Clint Eastwood story.
I don't know how, I can't imagine how he did it. Like, for a guy that doesn't smoke weed, I don't know how he did that. I don't know how he kept that shit straight in his head. Like when I was younger, and in high school, you know, I thought I could have everything and decided to cheat on my girlfriend at the time with her friend, which is like, hey, this is in high school. We are who we are and we act a certain way. But my
I wish I could have heard your inner monologue when you were like, this is not only going to work, but this is going to be so fucking cool.
Yeah, I know. This is fucking stupid. It's just like, this will work out. And they probably won't talk. Considering they're on the cheerleading squad together, I do not think they'll discuss this at all. This was what the problem with AIM at the time. When you had AIM and you were...
Oh, fuck AOL, man. They ruined us all.
I was a sweet talker on AIM. And so, you know, things progressed in a certain way. Anyway, shockingly, they found out and the entire cheerleading team saran wrapped my car in the middle of the night one night. Okay.
Honestly, when you first told me this story, I thought you were going to tell me, like, you know, humbly about the time the cheerleaders all beat the shit out of you. So when you said saran wrap car, I was like, honestly, you got off pretty late.
Oh, I got off easy. I mean, they harassed me. They sent me a lot. Yeah, it was bad. And thankfully, I learned very on. It's like, being a piece of shit does not pay off.
Yep.
So my point with that story is I don't know how he did it. Like the mental anguish.
It suggests it probably was more, and not all, I don't think. I mean, we know that Clint cheated for sure. But I do wonder how many of these were above board as far as hanging with people who felt the same way, who were like, yeah, you know, we're both going to do our things. Come hang out when you want to and vice versa, you know, because juggling that much as well is, especially being in the public eye, I'm just not sure is possible. Like if you're trying to be sneaky with that many things going on, I don't think it can happen.
Yeah.
So I wonder if like maybe most of this, especially after how bad it went with Sandra, I imagine Clint being like, fuck monogamy. I was right before. This didn't work. I'm worse off than ever. So maybe he went back in the other direction. I don't know.
Either, yeah, it could be anything. I mean, this is a guy who was, you know, like he's reacting emotion. You know, he's a, like his films, whatever he is emotionally feeling, you know, it's not the surface. So I mean, Eastwood came from a certain time where it's like, I'm sure he did not talk about his feelings. And in fact, I believe Sandra Locke had said, like, it's okay if you want to have affairs and all this stuff. Can we just go to couples therapy? Mm-hmm. And he didn't want to do that. And, you know, he was also purportedly burned that she wouldn't divorce her husband. But it's like, you know, I don't think that was out of jealousy. I think he said she had an addiction to him. And that might have been a money thing. But like, you know, I don't know exactly what was going on there, but something more than just the prospect of extra pussy propelled their relationship to dissolve and, you know, cause him to not even say anything when she died. The crazy thing is, like, nothing was said about when she died. It was like 5 days later that I think her daughter was like, yeah, she died. Like, no publication covered it. No other celebrities
mentioned. Very weird. Very weird.
Very, very weird.
Suspect, some might even say. Just saying.
Yeah, I just like, I guess the easy thing someone could be like, oh, well, these alleged things about Eastwood fucking with her career. Like, did he fuck with people giving a shit about when she died? I don't think that that's possible. I don't know how you even do that.
Yeah. That's a criminal mastermind kind of activity. If he fucked with her movies, maybe, of course, we'll never know, whatever. But yeah, saying it like sustained all the way through to make sure Variety didn't publish an article about Sandra Locke dying is that's silly.
I don't buy that. And especially where he was at the time he made The Mule, which is just looking back on his life as a bunch of failures that he perpetuated himself.
Yeah, he blames himself more and more as his career goes. So it would make zero sense that by the time she passes, he's like, yes, make sure no one talks about her because I'm still mad. I do not think so. I think he's mad at himself.
Oh, I'm sure he was. I mean, like she said, he hates himself.
Yeah.
She knew him better than most people. So what he does, though, with his performance in Bridges is just an excavation of an artist who is said to be too icy at times, maybe keep his feelings too close to his chest. I don't know. All I can say is that rain sequence, when she's reaching for that door to open it, if that doesn't move you, then I have said this before, but take have call one of your friends, go out behind your apartment in the alleyway, just let them shoot you in the head, because you are you're not going to feel anything through the rest of time. So
yeah, sociopath city, genuinely.
Yeah, death is the sweetest release for you.
Yeah, like all jokes aside.
No, literally all jokes aside. Kill you.
Yeah. If this movie does not move you emotionally, all of us probably should not hang out, and maybe you shouldn't hang out with anyone.
Yeah. Actually, before you kill yourself, go kill some people in Congress.
Yeah, do that, and then also deposit some money into our collective account. Yep.
Yeah. Steal all of Nancy Pelosi's titty upkeep money and give it to us. We love to support a woman, but you know, Will's edging. So, you know, I think support us. Like, you know, it's, yeah. Anyway,
I just want to without spoiling any actual specific, if you haven't seen it or you have and you think of it as, you know, just like a good Hollywood movie, which of course it is. It's a Hollywood movie and it is good. That's true. But I think part of why this is so amazing is, and why Clint fought for it and decided to direct it and keep the screenplay away from one Bruce Beresford and have Meryl, is that he clearly read this book and was like, there's an incredible core here, but everything else is ruined. And he strips away this until it is incredibly lean. In my opinion, this is some of the most economical filmmaking while still leaving room to breathe and not feeling rushed that I know of. Really? Like, that's it fucked me. I texted you after I rewatched. I was like, I'm stupid. I thought this movie was great, but it's one of the best.
Yeah.
Because like you said earlier, he is so smart, because what he did was he said, what we should do with Meryl's character is just observe her instead of trying to put something on her or make her a grand statement or anything like that. And my character as well is there to observe her and for us to explore each other and find out about the nuance of each other and just see what happens. And this movie is so quiet and calm. Much more European than you're used to if you watch a 90s American blockbuster, I would say, but not in the annoying ways. You know, nothing highfalutin here, and they didn't try to inject painful things like some Europeans did, especially at the time. This movie is just cut perfectly down to everything that matters about it, and nothing left. There's no fat on these, like no fat on this movie. It's perfect.
Yeah, I agree. If you could say, that it could be the book ending things with the kids.
Sure.
But I think that there's a kind of a nice dichotomy between the kind of ludicrousness of these kids, especially the son at the beginning of the movie, and his kind of like aghastness that his mother could have a private life all her own. Oh my God.
Well, let's just be real. The son's a cunt. So
yeah. But that's the point. I mean, I don't think they like them. And I think it's like, as much as like Douglas Sirk hated kids and the way they fuck with their parents, you know, this is in that territory. But you know, it is incredibly lean. And I think it's also like, to say kind of everything we're saying about Eastwood's affairs and everything going on, I mean, this is not a movie about a guy cutting loose and fucking his way through time. This is about a woman who is in a marriage that is good and has given her kids and has made her content with life. But and she never explicitly says what it is. It's probably lack of D, but there's
part of it,
but it's so much to like, she's unfulfilled. Yeah. She doesn't want to throw her marriage away, but she needs something else to constitute a life worth living. And
yes. A life running a real ass farm, because running farms is insanely fucking hard, no matter how small they are. So it's a hard, thankless life, even when your spouse and your children, you know, are quote unquote nice. You know?
Yeah, but they're not there, and their absence has given over to her mind, which has started reeling, has started questioning things. you know, it's such a beautiful portrayal of a woman caught in the crosshairs of their own guilt and pleasure, that, and it just doesn't make any judgment. There's nothing that like she has to pay for as a result of this or that. Like, it's as much as like we've talked about Eastwood and his affairs, this is about those women, in my opinion. It's about every woman he's felt something for and has looked at them and said, I don't know everything about you. Like, I am Clint Eastwood, and you look at me like you look at no one else, but there are still elements about you that I can glimpse at, maybe in your eyes or things you've done or say, but I don't know the interior space of you. And he's actually doing the smartest thing here, because he's not some fool trying to like play up, you know, the woman card and get points there, like by trying to delve into her psyche. Like, yeah, like I said, it's an observance. It's this very patient observance that's just balanced with so much humanity and understanding. And you know, there's a reason why a lot of moms loved this movie when it came mm-hmm. out. And a lot of guys,
not just for the reasons,
what to thinking. Do with it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, like you said, there's no, it's crazy. It pulls it off, but there is not a shred of moralizing here in any direction. Honestly, I guess maybe towards the sun, if there is any, but even that, not really, because the movie is smarter than that as well. But no, it's incredible. And it's so refreshingly not typical to American films at the time. And I think also my theory here, I don't think we've talked about this, but I think why, outside of obviously her talent and her natural beauty and their friendship, I think maybe why Clint knew that Meryl was the only choice for this. And we shared a clip earlier on, you know, of him at a tribute to her talking about her being the only choice and that he had no other ideas or backups. And I think it's because he's smart as well, and he sees Meryl's life reflecting the life of our main character at this point as well. Things are going good, technically. Her personal life is good. She's still in movies, but she's in movies like fucking House of the Spirits and River Wild right before this, right? And someone who is capable of the caliber of living and acting that Meryl is, it seems, at least from an outsider's perspective, she probably at this time was like, technically my life is good, but something feels off. And I think Clint saw that and was like, this is why you and I have to go on this journey together, and why they've had to shoot it in chronological order, because both their lives mirrored it so much in so many certain ways. And that's why it's such a powerhouse, you know, outside of all the technical merit, because again, everyone working on this movie couldn't be more on point, but it's Clint and Meryl.
And he got it in under schedule, as he
did. Oh, yeah, a couple weeks, right?
He always does. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he always kills it. He's like the most economic filmmaker ever.
And
he shot chronologically and got it under schedule,
which is impossible.
That's
no one does that. No one
really
does that.
Impressive. That's like, wow. Okay, yeah. Buddy.
No one does that. And he wrote the theme song too. I just wanted to bring that up, because the main theme with what's his name, Lenny Niehaus, wrote the main theme song together. So Clint cared so much about this story that he also did the fucking main theme song.
As he loves to do, he loves to get in there and deal with the music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean it's one of the best, and I don't think we see this kind of sensitivity towards romance appear probably for another 15 years in his filmography. And it comes to a kind of often derided, this is a contentious film in his filmography, shockingly, I quite enjoy it, is Hereafter, with Bryce Dallas Howard and Matt Damon. And this is a film that is definitely in lineage with Bridges Madison County, but even more in lineage with something like The Amazing Stories, Vanessa in the Garden, kind of returning to the supernatural world of like a being haunted by a relationship. And, you know, that movie, is praised for a very impressive opening sequence and then kind of derided as schmaltz. And it does risk being incredibly ludicrous. I am not saying it doesn't, but like Jersey Boys, you know, it somehow doesn't tip it. Like it you almost feel like it has the feel of listening, of feeling romance by listening to Coldplay in like a Barnes and Noble cafe.
We got Coldplay on the brain for a secret reason. Y'all will find out eventually.
Can't talk about that right now. We have Chris Martin coming to the theater.
Chris Martin is hosting Bridges of Madison County.
Yeah, we didn't want to break the news too soon. But Hereafter is probably his most emotionally naked, and that's probably why it was also derided, probably because there's an emotional vulnerability to that movie.
And there is more of an urgency to that movie with that emotion you're talking about, which is why I think people jump so quickly, right? Because you don't have the easy with Bridges. I think most people are not stupid, you know, see what it's doing in the patients and all this, but Hereafter is more urgent. So I think it's easier to just a knee jerk reaction, be like, oh, because it's fucking maudlin again. No, it's not.
Well, and Bridges has Clint in the movie, whereas this has his stand-in Matt Damon, which everyone likes to make fun of Matt Damon. Weirdly enough, like Eastwood couldn't get Matt Damon because he was shooting something at the time and was like, I will halt production to get Matt Damon.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? It works. Matt Damon is perfect for that movie in many ways. Like he's quite perfect. So, and then the following year in 2011, he does J. Edgar, which also is pretty apt at portraying a very sweet love between tortured individuals. And this time it's gay, folks. So he shows real love. I mean, he shows real emotion between Armie Hammer and Leo DiCaprio's characters in that movie. Like it's not there to just kind of hold historical place in that he had an affair with a gay relationship. Like that's the movie amongst a lot of other things. J. Edgar, boy, I wish we had time to just dive into all of what J. Edgar gets at, but alas,
that would be the first time we ever did an episode on one movie because we would have to.
Yeah, I mean, Eastwood is just that kind of person where it's just like you can go into a lot. But yeah, J. Edgar does it. American Sniper kind of shows the sad reality of a husband who can't communicate with his wife, mm-hmm. lost all form of ability to show emotion, and is just a hollowed out shell of a person. And I think that is probably one of the things that attracted Eastwood to it, because a man who is that torn between love, his libido, and whatever else is going on. I mean, I that scene of Bradley Cooper sitting at that bar, unable to come home to his wife on the phone, I guarantee something like that has happened.
Oh,
Eastwood's life. It's heartbreaking.
That's an exact scene that he's done many times, I think.
I mean, Eastwood knows the fragility of like the male ego. I mean, yeah, like it's funny to make fun of, and I'm not here to like be like support men more, but it's like
John's a men's rights activist.
I bet to a degree. I mean, it's like there's a level of like understanding that isn't given. And I don't mean that in a way of like excusing our worst behavior. I just mean like, you know, we're Neanderthals, so the closest to it in the lineage. So, you know, we don't use our heads as clearly as some of y'all do. And there's a tragicness to the complications of what a man expects, what they expect from the world, themselves, others, that just doesn't get met with the reality of the world, that women seem to have a better headspace for adapting to. And
that's why Clint is so adept at climbing into this world, because he was that image, still fucking is. Like that's why, as you said, so many men did not know what to do with Bridges in Madison County, because they were like, that's not Clint Eastwood. Excuse me. This is a gorgeous man who slays women everywhere and does not care about them. And he's tough and kills people. That's what he does. This is not right. he's not a sensitive, like, brilliant, calm photographer. Sorry.
Yeah, well, they're just like, can we have, yeah, cause, I mean, and honestly, not really to his credit. I mean, he doesn't follow Bridges up with anything of that kind of immense kind of power. Well, Absolute Power is the film that follows it, which I like Absolute Power, but that's just a fun time at the movies in that movie. It's just, yeah, if you've seen Absolute Power, you know what I'm talking about here. Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, same year. Great movie.
I love that one, but nowhere near what we're showing at this screening.
Nowhere near. True Crime. I know a lot of people like True Crime. True Crime's a tough one for me. That's one of the ones of his that I see merits to, but I'm not a big True Crime.
Well, that's where we switch, because you are slowly but surely getting me closer to Mystic River, and I'm going to work to do the same with True Crime. Get to Mystic River.
Yeah, I mean, I like True Crime, but it's just, there's not... The best part about True Crime is when it goes into his marriage and his ability as a father. I mean, the scene where he's racing the kid around that zoo and ends with her getting injured... That is where Eastwood gets close to Cassavetes.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
But the rest of the movie, the Space Cowboys. See, I'd prefer Space Cowboys over True Crime.
Well, Space Cowboys is way better than it should be at all. That movie's not bad, and it's pretty fun to watch. So,
there's a lot that can be said about Space Cowboys, and then. Bloodwork, and then, yeah, I mean, it's like Mystic River is kind of the next lauded film he gets. So that's 8 years after Bridges of Madison County, where the one fault of Mystic River is Sean Penn being cast in that fucking movie. Otherwise, good movie.
Maybe.
It's a good movie. It's a good movie. And then he's Mr. Oscar man, you know. It's kind of funny, like, it's like Million Dollar Baby, Flags of Our Fathers, Letters from Iwo Jima, Changeling, Gran Torino. And I mean, well,
Gran Torino is where it stops again, and everyone's like, who the fuck is this guy? Because that's when the general public turned back on him again.
Yeah, but not critically or box office. Like, that movie made a lot of money.
No. Yeah,
very well critically. People but they were still willing to accept him as a flawed character and someone who was knowingly calling back their previous roles of Dirty Harry and all these characters. But it's like Jersey Boys and American Sniper. I mean, he killed his career in terms of being like the critical darling at that point, because it's like American Sniper, masterpiece, but horribly misread because of the political turmoil of the time. And Jersey Boys, because no one expects Clint Eastwood to do a musical about fucking Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons and then turn it into turn it into an investigation of himself. Yep. That's what makes Jersey Boys so startling. Like, it's
yeah.
You go into that movie and then where it goes, you're like,
I mean, that's the Clint skeleton key. If people need it, if they've seen lots of his movies and don't feel like there's a connective tissue, it's all about him.
Yeah,
he's 24 interrogated himself from day one. Ebbs and flows, but it's always about interrogating himself.
If you're confused about him at that time, I do the three Clint film challenge.
Is it Invictus first?
No. You start 2011. You start 2011 with J. Edgar. You get walloped by J. Edgar, and you're like, okay, that's not what I thought Eastwood would do with a story about J. Edgar Hoover. Okay. He doesn't like J. Edgar and thinks that the government is a disgusting spy apparatus, and he's surprisingly emotional and responds to a gay romance. Okay, shocking. Then Jersey Boys and American Sniper right after. So you can be blown away by a J. Edgar and then grapple with where your headspace, where the world's headspace was at when he made Jersey Boys and American Sniper. American Sniper, kind of say what you want about how it has to do with the Iraq War. It's about soldiers and about how they're used. Jersey Boys is about being in the spotlight and making a lot of horrible decisions that affect your romantic life and your family life. but also maybe some kind of coded gay confessions in the movie. I don't know if gay confessions is the word, but there's a certain scene where a character who's questioning their sexuality is watching Rawhide on a television that's starring Mr. Clint Eastwood. Yep. So there's much more interesting things there when you think that this guy has given up and Sully is kind of the nice hangover morning after American Sniper, where he redoes American Sniper, but without a murderous piece of shit at the helm as the main character. And then 1517 to Paris continues to investigate that. The Mule just investigates him as a individual. It's amazing. Mule's amazing. If you think Mule sucks, again, I'm taking you out back and I'm plugging you in the back of the medulla oblonga. You're not even going to feel it. And then Richard Jewell, again, I'll take you back out your dead body and shoot it again if you didn't like Richard Jewell. So say what you want about Cry Macho. I think we've talked about it before. It's not Richard Jewell and the Mule, but if you don't believe that he directed most of Every Which Way But Loose and Any Which Way You Can, I kind of think Cry Macho is him being like, no, I did those because those were about road trips with a monkey or with an orangutan. Sorry. This is me and a chicken.
Me and a chicken and a big crush that will not die even though I'm 86.
Yeah. No, really. I mean, the way that
movie, he's still fucking horny, man. It is. Like, it sounds silly to say it, but
horny, that's but why
you know it's such a big part of the things that torture him. That dude is terminally horny.
I mean, yeah, he's terminally horny, and then he has a threesome in it. Yes. Third threesome after the two he has in the Mule.
Yep.
I mean, that's the kind of flexing where anyone else does it, you're like, okay. But it's like, no, that's he's probably underselling his sex life. But, you know, Cry Macho is, yeah, he clearly just wants to end up with love. That's his screen persona riding off into the sunset of Mexico to be with this beautiful woman and, you know, eat her food and dance. Like, that's like Peckinpah, like many of the people Ford who probably saw how they wanted to end their lives. It's probably being on a little Mexican ranch with a beautiful wife who makes you huevos rancheros all day, and you just have a beautiful
you dance together, because that's important for Clint too. He likes to dance.
That ending is means a lot more to if you really are a Clint head. You know, that ending is very sweet and beautiful.
And also, you know what? Another child performance that I'll go to bat for. I did not when it came out. I've changed on it recently.
I don't know if I've done it, but I
had, you know what, rewatching Gloria made me rethink Cry Macho, but we'll see. I still have to do the actual rewatch with that in mind and see if that's true or if I just want it to be true, because we don't know yet.
I want it to be true too. I'll tell you that, but I want it to be true too. There are moments where it's fine, but there are moments where it's like, is he too old to rein this kid in?
I'll report back.
And we'll say this much, Eastwood's not done.
Juror number two.
That's right. Juror number two. It's coming out. Let me see if there's a date for it yet. I know it wrapped last month, which it's Eastwood. That means it's coming out this year.
Oh, yeah.
He's quick.
It's supposed to wrap like next month from right now, and he was like, got it done.
Yeah, so it's it stars Nicholas Holt and Tony Collette, Kiefer Sutherland, J.K. Simmons is in it, Zoe Deutsch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm so pumped to see him and J.K. Simmons together. I feel like that's going to be nice, and I'm also, because he, I think, will understand what to do with J.K. Simmons instead of what everyone decided to do, which is just loud, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very curious what's gonna be of juror number two. But it's if you don't know what it is, it's apparently about a guy serving on a jury who is an alcoholic, which, you know, from the gauntlet all the way through Eastwood, that reoccurs I don't think Eastwood was ever a full-on alcoholic, but I think he understood the power that alcohol had over him. That guy was too in shape to be an alcoholic. So,
Yeah, well, he understands that people who talk about addictions and don't include all sorts of stuff are numbskulled. I think he understands you can get addicted to anything in life.
this is about a juror who's got an he's an alcoholic and he's serving on a murder trial, and then over the course of the trial realizes he might know or be a witness to or had an effect on the murderer in said trial. just
Pumped.
just uh just give it to us, please.
Just give it to us as soon as you can, please.
We would like that.
But yeah,
That's a
truly.
death. Yeah.
I'll go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, I think we've said enough.
Yeah, all I was gonna say to finish things out is, again, I know we said it, but believe it or not, as much as we enjoy to push envelopes here and there or whatever, we really cherish how special and moving movies like these two that we're showing can be. So we hope to see you guys there and hope that you agree. So we love showing action movies. We love showing shit like Freddy Got Fingered, but we would also love to be able to do stuff like this in regular rotation. And if y'all show up, then we can.
Yeah.
Which is cool. And we appreciate that you come to those when we dip our toes in them. But we love romance. We love musicals. We love westerns. I mean, you name it. We're very omnivorous with our obsessive love of movies, and we'd love to be able to spread those wings a little more. So if y'all pack it out with us on the true Mother's Day, which is Monday, May 13th, then we will have lots more like this and other things expanding our horizons
That's
coming
right.
soon.
That's right. Monday, May 13th, 7 p.m. Music box.
Music box.
All right. We'll see you there.
I'll see you there. I'm gonna go cry because I'm feeling emotional about Clinton
Yeah,
now.
and just listen, if your mom was gonna go out on Mother's Day, again, we've said it, but like let her chill on Mother's Day. Mother's Day is busy. There's too
Get her
much.
like a, if you need to do anything, set her up for a foot massage or just a massage or something, and get her some flowers. Bring whatever her favorite food is to her. Let her chill, knowing that y'all are gonna also have the most beautiful time together celebrating moms at Music Box the
Just
next
tell
day.
her, give her whatever she wants to, just whisper in her ear that she'll never die. And you'll never be sad from her death. Just do that. And then let your mom have the night she wants on the real Mother's Day, Monday, May 13th at the music box.
I do love though, because I suspect that we're actually preaching to the wrong people. I think there's probably actually a lot of moms in Chicago who are begging their children to come with them to Bridges in Madison County. And the kids are like, fuck no.
You're a shitty kid. You're like the parent. You're like the kids at the beginning of this stupid movie. You're pieces of shit, and you need to go see your mom and let her cry. And honestly, get out of her way. Go there and get her a popcorn. Get her a chum from Hopewell with 3% THC, and set her up in her seat, and just keep be her little errand runner if you don't want to watch a romance movie. Do whatever she wants. Let her have her time. But I promise, sit down. You'll love this movie. And if all this entire episode didn't get you super hyped to experience the movie from a certain perspective, one more time, you go out back.
And we remind you that
The
fucking.
cerebral cortex that can just.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah,
We'll see you out there.
You might be the kind of person who wants to worry about Drake and Kendrick having a spat right now. So you can stay home and listen to the two lamest rappers in the fucking world have their issues, where real heads know Almighty So 2 is out and Bridges of Madison County is on Monday.
Fuck Chicago and fuck their rules. Chief Keef is going to introduce Bridges of Madison County with us.
Yeah. Yes, he is. Truly, though, RIP to
Probably does love it, honestly.
that.
I could see it. I bet he's shockingly soft when he's not just watching SpongeBob.
I think he likes Lucky Number 11.
You might be right. I'm wishful thinking.
You're wishful thinking, even though he is the greatest artist to come out of Chicago in recent years. So salute to one who departed us, Mr. Steve Albini.
Agreed.
I was about to talk with him. And
I know. I tried not to ask that question because I had hoped it had just happened.
Nope, it didn't. But that's okay because he was a very kind person with the emailing and was just there's nobody like Steve Albini in this world. Respect to that man who stayed true his whole life. There it is. Check out Almighty So 2. Re-listen to a Slint album in honor of Steve Albini and go to Bridges of Madison County on Monday, May 13th. And Gloria.
Right after it.
Right after it. Okay.
All right. We'll see you all there.